Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornielsen, and you are listening to the webcast version of STEM Spots. With me in the studio today is Dr. Etta Madden. She's a professor of English here at Missouri State University. Thanks for stopping by, Etta.
Hi, I'm happy to be here.
Now, Etta, you're an English professor who studies and teaches primarily literature, and yet you're also interested in science, sort of the history of science and how it ties into writing. What got you to that point in your life?
Well, I was one of those students who went to college not sure that one particular major was going to cut it for me because my interests were so broad. So I ended up with a double major in biology and in English, and then pursued the path of becoming an English professor.
Now, had you always been interested in science from like the time you were a child and you liked to write? But you're doing literature, so do you like to read more than you like to write, or is it both things?
You know, I would say that I was pursuing science as a university student because I wanted to become an MD because I thought they had money and power, quite honestly.
Really?
But I always loved reading and writing, and reading more than writing, and I developed the writing as I've gone further along in my career.
And so you have these classes you teach, and you have the things that you study, and they're literature from the past, because I think you primarily teach pre-Civil War sorts of stuff. And so give us some examples of some places where there's the intersection of people of science from early parts of American history, perhaps, that people haven't heard about that are tied into literature in some way, shape, or form.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. You know, what I discovered as I was moving forward with my literary studies and teaching was that my love of especially earth science, biology, started coming out, and I couldn't repress it. And so as I was teaching these early American literary figures like Benjamin Franklin and Cotton Mather and Jonathan Edwards and Henry David Thoreau, I realized that everything that I knew about the biological sciences was coming back up as I was teaching those figures. So I had to share that with my students, because what those guys were doing was not just writing. They were interested in coming to new truths about the world that surrounded them. So, for example, Jonathan Edwards, known as the preacher who delivered the painful sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, people associated with Puritan, hellfire, and brimstone. He was a member of London's Royal Society, the premier organization of scientists in England. He was fascinated with physics. He was reading John Locke's philosophy, and he wanted to bring together what he understood about the natural world and what he was reading in the traditional scriptures of the Christian church as he knew it.
So these ways that they tied things together. Give us another example. So a person is trying to tie in their scientific interest and background into things that they saw in the lives of people. So how about another example of somebody that did that?
Well, so Cotton Mather, who is associated with the witchcraft trials in Salem, he became the historian who wrote the records of the court trials, and people think, oh, he believed in witches. He was crazy. He, too, was a man of science and was a member of the Royal Society, of which Isaac Newton was also a member. He, too, was trying to figure out how these supernatural powers, invisible powers, he called them, wonders of the invisible world, dovetailed with the science of people like Isaac Newton. And his writing is all about trying to figure that out.
And so another person you and I talked a little bit about together was Benjamin Rush, who was actually a physician, if I'm not mistaken, and had a lot to say about, well, a whole wealth of things. Discuss some of the things he was interested in.
Sure. So he became a founder of the Pennsylvania College of Medicine, but he's known as the father of psychiatry. He's also known as the father of the temperance movement. He really became quite famous during the yellow fever epidemic, partially because his treatments were considered radical. He's known as a performer of heroic medicine, which included bloodletting with leeches. We now think of that as completely crazy, but it was considered an important treatment method at that time. And he was bowed down to as this heroic figure in the years of the early republic.
Now, one of the things you mentioned to me was that sometimes these people from having a, let's say, a preferred background, they were high and mighty, they were well-respected, that this sort of informed the way they were viewed and gave lent credence to what they were doing. So were their writings, did their writings gain a lot of weight from this sort of behavior and attitude?
Absolutely. There are many things that Rush did at the time that were considered radical, and he brought on board a lot of people. Nowadays, we look at what he was advocating and we think, wow, that was a little bit crazy. He came up with an idea for what we would now call a restraining chair for someone that was undergoing some mental struggles or mental disabilities. We might think of that as cruel now, but in Rush's age, that was a radical improvement over just shutting someone away in an attic or in a basement. He also came up with what we now call behavioral treatment, giving people that might be shut away, giving them some kind of activity, exercise, teaching them skills, because he believed that that sort of work, if you want to consider it work, would help to treat their problems.
Right. Now, I know that many of these people, so you get sort of the idea of Benjamin Franklin, for example, who, although religious, came from a very secular sort of enlightenment kind of an idea, where it seems like a lot of the people you're talking about also had their own scientific beliefs intersecting quite strongly with their beliefs in the hereafter. Is that something that was very common in those days?
Well, you know, I think that exactly what they believed about the hereafter or another world wasn't completely clear. They were trying to figure that out because it was unseen.
Right.
And as men of science, they believed in empirical observation, empirical evidence. And so this is really, when you look carefully at their writing, you can see them wrestling with what they want to believe in, but what they can't put their hands on because the evidence isn't completely there.
So when you present this to students, for example, how do the students usually respond? First of all, would they know much about any of these figures, typically, in your experience?
Most of them know nothing about the figures except Benjamin Franklin, that they've heard he's a womanizer, and they might have heard something about his experiments with electricity. they might have heard of Jonathan Edwards in high school, but I'm finding that that's less and less the case because high school curriculum keeps shifting. That's the nature of learning. There's another man of science that I haven't mentioned, and that's Henry David Thoreau. A lot of people think of him as a philosopher and a somewhat advocating for civil disobedience, but he also was a man of science.
Sure.
What he had in common with those men before him was an obsessive desire to observe,
right,
to record in detail what those observations were, and then to try to figure out what it meant, to make sense of it, put it in some kind of order based on the patterns that he was seeing around
him. He would be like a classical naturalist, I think, in
absolutely
some way,
absolutely,
or form, now you and I talked about this, which was something that people that didn't have to dig ditches for a living could aspire to. Talk a little bit about what kind of people we're discussing here. Are we discussing people at the outside edges looking in, or are these people that have it all?
So you make a really good point. I've referred to 4 or 5 white males. And some listeners out there may be thinking, well, where are the women and where are the people that are not white? And that's a really, really good question. One of the points that I make when I teach these men is that these are men of privilege. They had the ability to do this because of the moments into which they were born and the positions into which they were born. Nonetheless, what I want to underscore is that they also were obsessed and dedicated to what they were doing. And one of the points that I'd make to my students that we can learn from these guys is that for us to learn, we have to be willing to give attention to details, to observe, to think critically, to look for the patterns, and to be open to the new ideas that this kind of attention brings us to.
Just out of curiosity, since you're teaching literature and you obviously have a great respect for the written word, how do you convey to students this idea that laying pen to paper, so to speak, or whatever it is that you do now, carries amount of permanence to it? Because you're reading things that are 250 years old or something like that, and yet now we have this sort of, what do you want to say, an inclination where things are created instantaneously and then they're forgotten instantaneously. Do students, are they able to appreciate sort of the the weight of this kind of literature? You know, the word literature sort of conveys this weight.
I'm not quite sure I'm understanding what you're asking.
I'm just asking, do you think the students really see the point in thinking seriously about putting down for sort of a permanent record a literary account of the things that they're doing? I mean, at one time, the naturalists would have said, I'm going to keep all these notebooks and I'm going to write every single thing that happened to me every day, because in their mind, people would be really, truly interested for a long time in what they had to say.
Well, I'm not sure that they were doing it because they thought people in the future would care about every little detail.
Right.
I think it's more like the people who are posting on social media every day or blogging, that they, part of why they were doing it is that they had a love of the process.
Right.
And that they themselves were able to see the patterns and make connections. And yes, Benjamin Rush was obsessed with fame. I think Benjamin Franklin was happy to think about his posterity. We get a sense of that in his autobiography. But there is another layer, which is taking pleasure in the process.
Right. So maybe some of the people just got lucky that their stuff stayed around for 200 years, because that wasn't really the point to them. The point was that they were writing it down for themselves, perhaps. So do you encourage students themselves when you talk about the attention to detail? I know you're analyzing literature, but do you encourage them to write down their whole part of the process when they're doing things?
So the way this translates into the literature classroom is that I encourage them, for all the reading assignments, to make note of what jumps out at them in the text, and to not just say, oh, it's in my head, I'll remember, but to write it down, even if it's in the marginalia, if they're reading electronic text, to highlight, but that all of that contributes to the learning process. And if they think that they're just going to be able to carry it all around in their heads, or that they can continually look it up on their phones, that they're going to be in trouble.
And so if you were talking to the average person, or if somebody were listening and they said to themselves, where's the intersection with my own life? And part of that comes to the whole point of why I read literature. I mean, I know why I do, and I know what makes me happy. But are there connections, people, lessons that people can learn just in general from this sort of thing?
Well, we've been sort of bouncing all over the place. But I think, one of the common threads here is that science means knowledge. We didn't talk about the etymology of that word, but I thought about it preparing for STEM Spots. And I'm not a scientist in the most colloquial sense of the word, the way that people think of it nowadays. But science has at its roots, etymologically, learning or knowledge. And any kind of learning and knowledge that we want to do requires attention to detail and an openness to critical thinking. And that also means an openness to the answers and the change that might call us to make.
Now, that's interesting, this word that you mentioned, change. So you and I discussed this a little bit, this idea that many of the things we've just discussed with the various people that we just discussed, their ideas have changed. Our opinion of the things they did have changed completely, but that's okay. So is that part of the whole idea, too, that you're going to think about things and you have to be comfortable with change?
I mean, absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. Because in science, Einstein once said that every theory hears its no. And for anybody who's worked in science, they know what that means. And we all know that sooner or later, something that you come up with is probably likely to turn out to be in some way, shape, or form incorrect. It's very difficult to come to grips with that, seeing as how you put your whole life into it sometimes.
Right. You know, Dave, there's another topic that we haven't touched on that is really important to all of these guys that I've mentioned, and the work that I do in the university classroom, and to listeners, I think. And that is that none of these men of science and none of us today works in a vacuum. That we tend to think about, a scientist working alone in a lab, or a writer being alone at the computer, or in a study writing. But even somebody like Watson and Crick, two guys who came up with the perfect diagram of the double helix, which, probably has been challenged since then, I'm not sure. But when you look at their autobiographical account of that work, they emphasize how their creative process is stimulated by other people who are also looking for scientific truths. And
Rosalind Franklin, who, if she had lived, would have won the Nobel Prize, presumably.
Okay. Tell me more about that.
So if you read, have you read The Double Helix?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a great book. So she worked in a different lab, but it was her X-ray picture that essentially gave the key piece of evidence. So But unfortunately, she passed away from cancer, and the Nobel Committee never awards a prize posthumously.
Okay,
so it's been an interesting bit.
It's been a while since I've read that, so I need to go back and read it now that I am trying to incorporate into these stories of men of science more about women of science.
Oh, yes, that's a very interesting story. A lot of people have been writing about that recently where they feel like, how shall I put it, credit was not awarded, let's just say, completely fairly. In that whole circumstance, it's very tricky.
Yes, and I recently have been looking at women of science in the 19th century since I teach in the 19th
right,
century,
sure.
And I have a list of some of those figures that other scholars are writing about. But they all their stories remind us of how many of these women have sort of remained under the radar, even though the work they were doing was really important.
Well, I need to get somebody in, maybe you or somebody else, to discuss that later, because we all know, anybody that's been in physics knows how there's been undervaluation over the years and that women have had to fight harder. It's getting better. It's not perfect by any stretch, but at one time it was extremely difficult. There's no doubt. That's a show for another day. Etta, I really appreciate you stopping by and talking about all these interesting ideas, and I thank you very much.
I've enjoyed it. Thanks for inviting me.
Once again, this is Dave Cornelison for STEM Spots signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.